Merci beaucoup de m'avoir invité. J'ai donc vécu au Gabon jusqu'à j'avais 15 ans. Ça fait déjà assez long. Donc, je suis en train d'oublier le français. Et c'est aussi vrai que pour moi, parler en français sur les sujets scientifiques est très difficile. Donc, je vais parler en anglais. Vous avez tous, je pense, une petite synopsis de ce que je vais dire qui est traduit en français. Et aussi, les slides seront en français. Mais d'abord, je veux commencer avec quelque chose. Je vais commencer en anglais maintenant. Et je m'excuse pour ça. Et so David spoke about the réseau that you have here in France with the GBU. And I just want to tell you something that I'm very involved with in Oxford that might be interesting for you to look up online. This is Oxford Christian Mind. It's a course we run for graduate students and faculty twice a year. One's a general course and one has science, social science, history, law, literature streams. And these are some pictures of the Christian professors at the university who teach on this course. And we have quite a bit of video content up. So just to say that this is one of my great passions, something that actually my wife and I spend a lot of time working on and organizing. And so we're very interested in how to think Christianly about these subjects. What I'm going to speak about today is really a more scientific talk. I was asked to speak about self-organization. And so I want to give you a little video to see the kind of self-organization I'm interested in. So this is a video of a bacterium. Little bacteria swim inside your body. And one of the ways they swim is with these little flagellar motors. There's a little motor that spins. This motor can spin at 100,000 RPM. It can stop in a quarter of a turn. It's an absolutely amazing little piece of nanomachinery. If you were to find someone that you could, one that you could see with your eyes, you'd assume it was produced in a factory somewhere. A lot of complicated people or organization needed to put it together. But these things make themselves. And so about 7 or 8 years ago, I saw this video made by Keiji Namba's group in Osaka. It's an animation of how we think the bacterial flagellar motor assembles. I thought, that is amazing. All those particles just float around and come right into exactly the right space to make a little motor. It goes well beyond anything that humans are able to engineer at this point. And so I was very interested, like, how does that work? It's strange. It's amazing. It's something, I think as a Christian, you look at something like this and all you can really do is give glory to God. For those of you that like to think about these things, you in fact have 10 times as many bacteria in your body as you have cells in your body. Okay? Before you run off to the hospital, that's fine. The bacteria are much smaller than your cells. They live in your gut, for example, in your intestines, and they do very many good things. So while I'm speaking to you, this process right here is happening millions of times. Typically takes between 20 minutes and an hour for one of these machines to be made. So during my talk, a whole bunch of machines will be made inside of your body. Something to think about. Now, for a physicist like me, a theoretical physicist, these bacteria are far too complicated to understand. So I've worked on things like this, a virus. Well, a virus is also a really simple little organism. It's a shell made of proteins. In fact, you can make the shell and look at the shapes. I don't know if you can see that with the light. Can you see the colors on them there? Here you'll see this one has 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons, which is the same stitching as an old-fashioned football. So nature got there a long time before we did. And what's amazing is you can take these particles, these little shells, take the DNA or the RNA out, so you have just a little protein shell, and if you put them in a test tube and change the salt conditions or the pH, they'll fall apart into individual units. And then if you change it back to its original condition, all those little units will float around and pop right back into however many balls you had there in the first place. It's a little bit like Lego blocks that you put in a box and you shake and out comes little tiny balls. So I was very interested in how does that work? You know, what are the properties that you need to have particles that would form little balls like this? And here's an example of the kind of work we've done in my group. So here are a bunch of pentagons that float around. They move randomly. Okay, so the motion is completely random, par hasard, if you wish. And they nevertheless form every single time these very well-defined shapes. So once the particles are designed correctly, then it doesn't matter in what order you put them in or how they move, they will eventually form exactly this shape. Or if I put a different set of particles in, they'll form these shapes. I sometimes tell my... these are all done on the computer, so these are model viruses. They're not real ones. But we think that by understanding the process on the computer, we may understand something that's happening in real life as well. So we understand something about the principles of how this Lego works. These viruses work. So I say to people, what I'm doing is trying to understand how to take Lego blocks, put them in a box, shake the box, and if I do that carefully, I should be able to get a fully formed train. Who said that science wasn't fun? So the question that I'm interested in is, what are the properties of particles that will allow this to happen? Because if I could do that, first of all, I'd become very rich. All your children would want to have my self-assembling Lego trains. But also, we might understand something about the way our bodies work, about the way biology work, and we might be able to intervene with medicine, with nanomedicine, small things that could do some really powerful interventions in our bodies. So I'm interested in the mathematical properties of this, because think about it for a minute. If I take little Lego blocks and I just put glue on them, okay, and I shake it, I'll get junk. And every time I do it, I'll get a different junk, but it'll be junk. Because the number of incorrect ways for them to stick together is much, much larger than the number of correct ways to stick together. Right? So how do they know where to go? How did those bacterial proteins that floated around, how did they know where to go? It's a very interesting question. I'm not the first person to ask this question. In fact, I'm going to give you one very famous example of this question, which those of you that have some biology background will remember. So proteins, which is what the kind of molecular workhorses of the cell, are made of these long strings of amino acids, 20 different kinds. And so they're a long string particle, but they can form a little three-dimensional shape like this. They fold into a three-dimensional shape, and that shape determines their biological function. So they need to fold into a really well-defined shape, almost exactly the same shape each time. And a long time ago, over 40 years ago, a famous biophysicist, Cyrus Leventhal, said, how does that work? If I have a protein like this, made of lots of different units, then the number of conformations is really, really big. Let's say I've got a length 150 protein, which is actually quite a small one. The first one, let's say it has 10 different angles it could make with its neighbor, the first amino acid. 10 angles. The second one has 10 angles with this neighbor. The third one has 10 angles with this neighbor. The fourth one has 10 angles with this neighbor. Each one's 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. So adding the number of different ways this chain can be, it really quickly becomes so big that if you take any reasonable time of motion, it would take longer than the age of the universe for it to search through all possible conformations. So how does it search through all these conformations and find this really well-defined shape? Well, the answer to that paradox is that my question was wrong. Like most paradoxes, the reason they work is because you pose the question in a way that's biased. And in this case, the idea is that, in fact, the protein needs to search through the whole space. It doesn't. A protein which folds correctly, so a protein which goes from that long string to a well-defined shape, has inside of its shape of possible conformations what we think is something like a funnel. It doesn't matter where it starts, it'll always end up at the bottom there. So the search is not random. Even though it moves around randomly, right? But something about the space of the search always has you end up at almost exactly the same space. And in fact, when I showed you those viruses before, the way I designed those viruses so that they on my computer formed the right shape was in fact using the same picture of an energy landscape, same picture of a funnel. And these were the ones that worked are the ones that have the right kind of funnel landscape where you can easily go from many conformations and end in the bottom. One way of thinking about this is to think about a golf course, okay? So if I say to you a protein has each angle is 10 different possibilities with its neighbor, 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, a length of 150 is 10 to 150 different conformations, how could I ever find anything? What I'm saying is it's like I'm a blind person looking for a golf ball on a golf hole on this course. And everywhere I look is exactly the same. So I have to look everywhere and hope that by chance I find that little golf ball. That would be the way the paradox is formulated. But what if, in fact, I'm working around here and the golf hole is in the bottom? It doesn't matter where I start, I'll always end up in the bottom. I'll always make my hole fall into the golf. My ball will always fall into the little hole. Of course, if golf was like this, it'd be a little bit boring. But you can see that even though there are many possible ways of getting down there, it doesn't matter where I start, I'll always get there. So what I just wanted to show you with this really simple example is that your body is full of systems that in fact move around randomly and nevertheless, in spite of the random motion, have very well-defined outcomes. So the outcome is very well-defined, even though the actual microscopic motion appears to be entirely random. And this brings me to really the main point I want you to take away from my talk is this one point, which is that when we speak about randomness, the reason why that often makes Christians uncomfortable, the reason why it makes sometimes people claim that randomness is somehow something that is in favor of atheism, is because there's a confusion about metaphors. Randomness is in many ways a metaphor for sometimes our lack of knowledge, sometimes for really true ontological randomness, perhaps in quantum mechanics, as was discussed this morning. But the point is that for many problems in our world, random techniques are the most efficient way of solving problems. So, for example, how many of you have heard of Monte Carlo methods? Oh, good. See, I like this. This is a great audience. So, good. So most of you have heard of Monte Carlo methods. Great. I like this. So you know that in a Monte Carlo method, right, you have random trial moves. You try them randomly, and you have some acceptance criterion, and you get a certain answer out. In fact, you can prove without too much difficulty that for high-dimensional integrals, Monte Carlo methods are much more effective than a wide class of non-stochastic methods. And so I sometimes say it would be better, a lot better for us if in, for example, biological language, we wouldn't use the word random mutations, we'd use the word stochastic mutations. Then immediately the general public would realize this is not a metaphysical language. It's just it's a way of discussing something. And in fact, if you think about it, if God were to want to design complicated beings, it's very likely that a random process of the Monte Carlo type would be by far the most efficient way of doing it. So it's perhaps not surprising that we see these random processes all around us in nature. And so nature uses this random process to, in real time, search through enormous, we call hyper-astronomically large spaces, because these are very efficient ways of finding final states. So that's the main point I wanted to take away from today, which is that the metaphor of randomness is a lot more subtle, and sometimes random processes can have pretty well-defined outcomes. And I just looked for fun on the French Wikipedia page about hasard, and this is the picture they have of a man and a woman, clearly kind of an Adam and Eve, and it says, l'apparition de l'espèce humaine est-elle due au hasard? So, did we appear by chance? Is it random? Right? Does it have no meaning, no purpose, as we heard in some of the quotes this morning? And I think I'm going to argue two things. I'm going to argue that God could, of course, have done things in many different ways, but I'm going to argue that probably God used these stochastic methods rather than random methods in order to design humans like ourselves, or design processes like self-assembly and a whole series of things. So that was the first little point about randomness. That's the main point I want you to take away. I'm now going to get into some more details and ask you a little bit more about questions about ourselves as biological organisms, our genes. And there's some really interesting things when you think about how do you randomly search through the space of genes, for example. So one really interesting surprise that came out of the Human Genome Project is how few genes we have. So the expectation early on that humans would have something like 150,000 genes, but in fact we have very few. So here, this E. coli, a little bacterium, has 5,000 genes. Yeast has 5,800 genes. The C. elegans here, which is a little worm, has between 19,000 and actually that's old, it should be 23,000. And humans are not that different from these little tiny worms, a tiny worm with 950 cells. So one question that immediately arises from this is, why do we have so few genes? In fact, you can take that further. We share a lot of our genetic makeup with other organisms. So, for example, we humans share 98% of our genes with chimpanzees. And in fact, this is a picture of myself and my pet chimpanzee, Berche. So when we lived in Gabon, my parents are biologists. We had a chimpanzee that I grew up with. In case you can't tell the difference, this is me, and that is a chimpanzee. Okay? My mother says we look different, but we behave remarkably similarly. So I've always wondered what made me different from my chimpanzee brother, Berche. Why were we not the same? Given that we share 98% of our genes, 99% of our genes, depending on how you count, what makes us different? Well, one thing that makes us different is not the number of genes, but the way that the genes are connected together. So if we look at the genes that we have, one thing that we've learned in the last few decades is that a lot of genes are switches. So this is a picture of the gene network in a bacterium called E. coli. Each dot represents a gene. Each line with arrows on it tells you what that gene does to the other. Many genes are switches. They switch things on, they switch things off, they turn other genes on and off. They affect other genes. All right? And if you think for a minute, the image that many of you have in your mind of genes are like a genetic blueprint, a plan, a Bauplan. It's like looking at an architectural drawing, you look at the genes and you can figure out what is going on. But that may not be the best metaphor. A different metaphor might be the metaphor of a computer chip, where you have a bunch of little things that you can reconnect, and you can make something into an oscillator, you can connect it, and it can become a switch. And the same units can be hooked together in different ways to generate radically different behavior. So one of the interesting things to think about is, rather than speaking about genetic blueprints, you might want to think about genetic chips that can be rearranged, which is why we can have many of these dots be the same between ourselves and chimpanzees, but maybe we can rearrange the way they connect and the behavior, the biological outcome will be really different. That's another example of an image, a metaphor, which, you know, neither metaphor is correct completely, but it helps us to think about the way these things are different. There's a few other, I'm going to skip this bit here, it's a few other technical bits, and I'm going to just want to leave that in as another metaphor, a metaphor of genes, not just as blueprints, but also, if you wish, as computer chips. And then I want to think, can I say anything about evolutionary design, how things are designed in evolutionary time? And of course, Christians have disagreements with each other about how much of what we see around us is caused by evolution. But I think every Christian agrees that in some sense, evolutionary methods are at work. We see, for example, bacteria, which get resistance over time. And in fact, your own immune system, which fights other pathogens, one of the reasons why it can use a small number of components and yet fight a very wide range of different pathogens that attack is because it uses an evolutionary optimization method in order to change really quickly and find the best way of fighting disease. So I gave you this one example, which was the example of the folding protein, the protein that folds in three-dimensional space to a well-defined shape. And the question was, how could it in real time search through that whole space of possible states and find the final state? And the answer to that is that the search is not random. The search is somehow biased in a particular direction. And the interesting question would be, what about searching in evolutionary space, right? Searching in the space of design, the design space. What does that look like? Is that also random? That you could, is that in the sense that it's uniformly random, so you could go in any possible direction, it's all the same, or could that state space be biased in one way or the other? And a very famous paradox is brought up by Sir Fred Hoyle, who is one of many people who pointed out that if these proteins are made of 20 different amino acids, then at each point I could have 20 different units. So I could have 20 different ones here, 20 there, 20 there, 20 there, 20 there, 20 there. Because the protein has a direction as well, if it's length 100, there are 20 to the power 100 different possible sequences. And then you could ask yourself, well, how big are those numbers? Well, it turns out that if you take 58, which is a very small protein, and you made every single possible length 58 protein, it would weigh more than the visible universe. Okay? That's a very large number. So that's just the power of exponentiation. You know, if you exponentiate powers, they just grow and grow and grow. And in fact, the average length of a protein in a human is 470 long. If you made every single protein of length 470, it would weigh more than 10 to the 500 times the mass of the universe, which is 10 to 500 is one of the numbers that get bandied about in multiverses, so that's why I put that in. So it weigh more than the multiverse. So clearly these are nonsensical large spaces, but it does mean that one thing that nature can't do is search through the space of all possible sequences. And the question that was unraised is then, given that that's the case, given that these design spaces are so incredibly big, how does a bacteria do anything? How can it respond and get resistance? How could you design something like that self-assembling little motor? How could you ever find anything like a virus when the design space is just hyper-astronomically large? And that's an open research question to which I think the answer is unknown. But I'm going to tell you some very recent work from my own lab that I think at least shines some light on it, and I think is fun to think about. So one thing we know is that I formulated the question slightly naively, because counting the number of different sequences is not the same as counting the number of different outcomes. Okay, so a protein has a sequence made of an alphabet of 20 different amino acids, but many of those sequences are redundant. So if I have a particular shape and a protein does a particular thing, so maybe a protein is a catalyst, an enzyme, it catalyzes a reaction, then sometimes two proteins can have up to 90% sequence dissimilarity. So the sequences are 90% different from each other, and yet they do exactly the same function. So we'd say they're effectively the same protein because they're doing the same thing. So that really lowers the number of possible states a lot. Right? It's still true if you have 10 to the 500, you know, it doesn't really help you very much if you drop it by a factor of 10 or even by a factor of 100 or by a factor of 1,000. You're still very, very big. But at least that tells us that these spaces are somewhat smaller than we might think. So what you would say as a biologist is you'd say, how many genotypes are there? So how many different sequences are there? And how many phenotypes are there? How many different actual outcomes are there? And in fact, when you try to infer evolutionary histories, people will look at a protein or sometimes a transfer RNA and look at how much it's changed over time. Because there's so much redundancy, there's neutral mutations, you can use it as a molecular clock to measure evolutionary time. So we know this happens, that there are many, many more sequences than there are outcomes, phenotypes. And so the question that we asked is a very simple one. If there's many more phenotypes and genotypes, how are these distributed? So let's say that there are 1 million genotypes and 1,000 phenotypes. Does each phenotype have 1,000 genotypes that maps onto it on average with some small spread, or is there a bias in that distribution? That's the question. It's a very simple question. You can kind of see I've got many genotypes, I've got a lot more genotypes than phenotypes, so how are they distributed? And the real answer to that question is that it's a difficult question to answer because we often don't know. We haven't searched. It's really hard to search through these spaces. But what we can do is look at model systems. So here's a very simple model system. This is RNA. So you see here, as you as you go along, there's a sequence of four different letters, U, G, C, and A. And G and C like to bind together, and G and U, and A and U also like to bind together. So if I have this particular sequence, U, A, A, G, all the way around to here, I can ask myself, what's the ground state, the free energy minimum state, for that thing to fold into? It'll fold into a particular well-defined shape. And I can ask myself, who binds to whom? And if I have this particular shape, then I'll call this the phenotype, because that shape is what determines, to a large extent, what this thing actually does. So that shape is the phenotype. And I can see that, you know, if I take, for example, here, the G and the C, and I make this a G and that a C, then I've got the same bond, and so I probably have the same state as my ground state. So there's many different sequences that will give you this particular shape. Right? Does that make sense? So I can ask myself, the genotypes are the sequences, the phenotypes are the shapes, and then I can ask myself, how do these genotypes map onto the phenotypes? And in fact, I know that there are 4 to the power 15, which is 2 to the power 30, which is a billion different sequences, and we've calculated, and there are exactly 431 different shapes that those sequences make. So it's a billion sequences make 431 shapes. And the question then is, how are those sequences distributed over the shapes? Well, then you get something very interesting, which I'll just talk you through. So this shape right here has about 11 million sequences that map to it. This one has about 10 million. This one here has only 2 that map to it. So what you see is that these sequences vary hugely, or these structures vary hugely in the number of sequences that map to them. In fact, the first 26 of the 431 sequences take up 50% of all possible, the first 26 of all 431 possible shapes take up 50% of all possible sequences. So they take 500 million of sequences. In other words, there are 400, I started with a space of a size 1 billion. I have a chance 1 in a billion of getting a sequence at random. Then I said there's only 431 shapes. So that tells me if I just grab something, I've got a chance 1 in 431 of getting a shape. But in fact, if I just randomly grab a genotype, I've got a chance 1 in 2, a 50% chance of getting one of these 26 frequent shapes. So my space that's very, very large has dramatically shrunk. And not only has it dramatically shrunk, but a very small subset of those possible shapes are highly preferred by this mapping from genotypes to phenotypes. Does that make sense? That's a key idea that I'm trying to get across. So what I'm trying to explain to you is, if I'm searching in the design space of shapes and I'm randomly looking through the sequence of genotypes, I'm actually heavily biased towards a certain subset of shapes. I'm very likely to get these guys and very unlikely to find these. And that's interesting, because it's been known for some time that if you do experiments on RNA, you see what's called convergent evolution. So RNA, you know, RNA is like DNA. It's a very similar chemical structure. One of the things that it does is the DNA gets translated into RNA and then transcribed into protein. So it's a messenger. But other RNAs can do things like act like catalysts. They can be like proteins. They can catalyze reactions. In a very famous experiment, Jack Szostak, a Nobel Prize winner, took a lot of random RNAs of around the length 50 to 60 and then asked himself, can I make one that will be a catalytic, which cuts itself? It's a self-cleaving enzyme. And so he ran the experiments, which made random sequences and selected for catalytic activity until he found catalysts. And every time he did that experiment, he always found exactly the same catalyst, this one right here, called the hammerhead ribozyme. It's got this very specific three-armed shape. And it was a very big surprise when these experiments came out, because there are known to be other ribozymes, or expected to be other self-cleaving ribozymes, but every time he ran his experiments, he kept finding the same one. Well, for length 55, the actual search space is hyper-astronomically large, so you think you could never find something more than once in that space, but he keeps finding the same thing again and again. And so what's interesting is, when we've looked at these, at this space, a larger space than the space I just showed you, what we find is that this hammerhead ribozyme is exactly in the peak of the most likely structures that you're going to find. And so the reason why the reason why Szostak and his collaborators keep finding the same ribozyme in this gigantic, hyper-astronomically large space is because it's the easiest one to find. Not because it's necessarily the best one or the only one, but because the space is very heavily biased towards this very small subset of different structures. So that's an example of searching now not in real time, but over evolutionary time in the space of sequences. And what I'm showing you is that that mapping from sequences to structures is very heavily biased towards a very small subset of all possible outcomes. And that may explain why we see evolutionary convergence, why the same thing keeps appearing again and again. But the story goes further. So I showed you the beginning, that little bacteria flagellar motor, right? You remember this one here that assembles itself. And the obvious question is, how on earth could evolution design something like this? Right? It seems impossible. And yet we know this motor has appeared numbers of times, so it must be possible to do. And the question would be, more generally, how do you form these kinds of clusters? And it turns out that a lot of proteins in nature are they're made of little clusters. Like this right here is a little tetramer made of four, or a pentamer made of five, or a hexamer made of six. And you can go through the database of all possible proteins and look at them. And what you find, rather surprisingly, is that the simpler the shape, the more likely that you're going to find it in nature. Okay, so I don't know if you can see this, but this one here has 10 units. Okay, I'll do it like this. This one right here has 10 different units, but it's very frequent. We find them several thousand times in nature. Whereas this one also has 10 units, this one right here, it's very rarely found. And it's clearly a more complicated shape. And if you think about it intuitively, well, if you are trying to search in the space of proteins that assemble into little shapes, it's much easier to find this one, for which you only need a small number of interactions, than for this one, for which you need to evolve a lot of different interactions. So this one should be intuitively easier to find than this one. So what we've done in our lab is we've tried to model this process. So model the process of designing shapes that form these little protein particles. And what's kind of interesting about that is, well, first of all, it's really hard to do. So we have, this is a physicist's model of proteins. So our proteins are little squares. The squares interact with each other with a matrix of interactions. I won't bother you with the details, except that I can say to my program, make a 16-mer, for example. So a 16-mer is a little thing made of 16 shapes. So I say evolve a set of patches, okay? Patches are the interactions between the sides of the protein such that you make a particular shape. So for example, we asked the computer to randomly make little patches and then search for 16-mers. So 16-mers is made of 16 little blocks that self-assemble every time into exactly the same 16-mer. That's modeling what's happening in nature when these proteins form these well-defined shapes. Now, it turns out that there are 6,849,777 different ways you can take little squares and put them into a 16-mer block. Okay, turns out there's a piece of recreational mathematics called polyominoes. You know, dominoes, right, is 2, triminoes is 3, 16-ominoes is 16. And people have spent a lot of time counting the number of different ways you can arrange them. And there's this many different ways. So you might expect that if I search through that space, that I would find them with a probability of 1 in 6.8 million. But in fact, these ones here, these first 10, the one colored in red, they appear 50% of the time when I search in the space. So rather than 1 in 6 million, I've got much, much, much higher probabilities of finding this very small subset of these guys, these ones right here. And if you look at them carefully, like this one, or that one, or that one, you'll see that they're very symmetric, right? They're very modular. They're kind of the pretty ones. So it turns out that the symmetric and modular ones are the ones that are easier to find. And they're the ones that evolution keeps finding again and again. And in fact, I didn't tell you this, but in the RNA, the same thing is true. So those subset of shapes that are easy to find are also the shapes that have a much higher symmetry or a much higher modularity. So that's very surprising, right? So a very small subset of all possibilities is what an evolutionary algorithm keeps finding again and again. It's a completely random algorithm in the sense that it's randomly searching through the genotype space, but it's not random because I'm trying to make it find 16 MERS, but when it searches, it finds a very small subset of them again and again. And the question for you then is, why is that the case? And now I am going to veer off into more specialist territory, but I think it's kind of a fun piece of mathematics that if you haven't heard about it before, you really ought to, because it's so beautiful. So this comes what we call the theory of algorithmic information. And this is a theory that's part of theoretical computer science, and the great fathers of this field are Kolmogorov, Chaitin, and Solomonov. And what they did was to ask themselves the following question. If I have an object, okay, how complicated is that object? And the way that they decided to describe the complexity of that object is by saying, what is the length of the shortest program that can make that object? Okay. So what does that mean? I'll try to explain it. So if I have here, I don't know if you can see it with the light, but here I've got 0101, right? Do you see this? 0101. Turns out that this is 100 characters long. And so the question is that simple or complicated? Well, it's clearly simple because I can write down print 01 50 times, okay, in a program, and it'll print that. Right? So that's clearly a very simple pattern. Whereas this pattern here is just a whole bunch of numbers in a row. Okay. And in fact, if this was a truly random sequence, then the shortest possible program is just print the number, because there's no other way of describing it. Now, for the real geeks in the audience, you'll recognize that these are the first 100 digits of pi. Right? So in fact, there is a way of writing it down in a shorter code. But if I change one number, then it would be truly random all of a sudden. So what are these guys saying? These guys are saying the correct way of describing randomness, the mathematically deep way of collecting randomness, is to ask myself how random something is how long the program that I need to describe that object is. If the program is short, it's simple. If the program is long, it's complicated. And at some point, the program becomes as long as the pattern, in which case it becomes complex. There is no shorter description of something than the thing itself. Does that make sense? Now imagine that you are a gene and you're trying to describe an output. What you are is you're a little code, right? And you are translated by biology, which is the computer, into some kind of output. Then if the output is simple, then the code is short. If the output is complicated, the code is long. But typically, your genes are quite similar in length when they're trying to do, like the RNAs are all the same length. So if you have a short thing, but you've got a lot of space to write it, you can write it in lots of different ways. Right? So there are many different ways of writing it, which means there's many different genomes that make it, which means it's really easy to find. Does that make sense? So that's in some sense the connection. In fact, you can formalize this connection. This is what Solomonov made very famous. He said, if you have another way of describing the complexity of something is to say, if I have a computer and I just feed it random input, so I just feed it random codes and I look at what comes out, then the more complicated something is, the more code I have to put into it, the lower the probability that a random code generates that object. Right? That's a complicated object. A simple object, I'll put a few random codes in and boom, it'll come out. Does that make sense? It's an obvious intuitive idea. Simpler things are easier to generate by random codes than complicated things are. In fact, you can formalize it, and if I write k as the length of the shortest program that generates something, then my probability is dominated by 1/2 to the power of the shortest length. So that tells me the true complexity that something has. So that means that the probability of getting a certain output is linked to its Kolmogorov complexity. This is one of the very deep principles of this field. And in fact, this means that if I have in this case, a Turing machine, and I feed it random inputs, then the most likely outputs are going to be the simplest, more modular, more symmetric outputs, which is exactly what I'm claiming to see in all these biological examples. And that's just a long way of saying that randomness is often a lot more subtle and complex than you might think. I've actually been throwing together a number of different ways of thinking about randomness. This complexity language is another very deep and powerful way to formalize concepts of randomness in physics. But the most important thing to remember is that just because something is a random process at its base doesn't mean that the outcomes are necessarily going to be random. Or, in fact, that the outcomes are therefore unpredictable or don't have any pattern to them at all. And that, I think, is a very important general principle just to remember in all of our discussions about randomness. So I'll finish by saying, well, these metaphors about randomness, I try to combine them with evolutionary design and questions of self-assembly. And I argued that in real time, self-assembly works because it doesn't search randomly through all trajectories. It searches in a slightly biased way through trajectories. Proteins that fold into the right shape, little proteins that make these little motors into the right shape, don't do so because they're searching through all possible search spaces. They're searching in a collective and controlled and organized way. In evolutionary time, I'm arguing, but these are fairly new and controversial arguments in science, that evolutionary designs, because the mutations, which are random, nevertheless highly privilege a very small subset of outcomes. And so I think it's interesting to speculate about what this might mean, and maybe it doesn't mean that much, except that it's interesting to think about. I think as Christians, we also have to be careful in trying to extract too much purpose from nature, doing natural theology, looking at nature and extracting purpose, in the same way that sometimes people who argue the other direction tend to do. So a famous colleague of mine, Richard Dawkins, is essentially a natural a-theologian. Right? He takes the natural world and extracts what are effectively a-theological messages from that. I think I don't even need to disagree with him about any of his science in order to show that that kind of natural theology is extremely unhelpful. In the same way, we would probably disagree about some of this science. I'm saying something very different from what he would say. But I don't think that I've therefore disproven him or proven him anything in all of his kind of theological arguments. But I have pointed out, I think, that the concept of randomness, certainly in the biological world, is a lot more subtle and more rich and worthy of study than I think sometimes has been realized. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention and your patience with my English.